I hope you know Rebel Radio is supported by Audible. Love them for that. You know, if you talk to most people about living in LA, they'll say the worst thing about it is the traffic. You know me, I really don't mind the traffic because I use it as my listening time. I listen to books on Audible, and it's really changed my career, my whole reading, all of that. There's an unbeatable selection of books on Audible. I listen to fiction, a lot of mysteries, business books, personal growth, biographies. I just finished a great book called Let's Go Crazy, Prince and the Making of Purple Rain, written by Alan Light. It's if you're a Prince fan, you got to get into that one. I'm about to start on The Drop by Dennis Lehane, which looks cool. I go through like a book a week, something crazy like that, because I use my time in the car, in the gym, on the bike. Whenever I'm on a conference call ignoring everybody, I'm listening to Audible. Go to Audible and get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial, audible.com/rebel. That's a special code only for fans of Rebel Radio. Because we love you, we hook you up. audible.com/rebel.
What's up? This is Thess One from People on the Stairs and many other things. Checking out Rebel Radio, the best. So stay tuned. And fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
What did you say, Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where we talk to the rebels who are shaping our culture. We learn how they do it, why they do it, and how you can get a little piece of the pie for yourself. I'm your host, Josh Levine. My guest this week is Thess One, one half of People Under the Stairs. He's a rapper, he's the producer, he's the manager, he designs the merch, he runs all of the business. He's a real DIY type of dude, and he's gonna tell us how he's built a business that's continued to thrive over the years, how they keep making music after there's no more genres. He's gonna tell us a little bit about his beef with Will.i.am and why competition is good for creativity, right after our EDM.com track of the week.
Yeah. We gotta preserve this thing we call hip hop, man. I was born into this.
24/7,
rapping hip hop, man.
24/7,
never going pop, boy.
24/7,
rapping hip hop, man.
24/7,
never going pop, boy.
No, they say that I'm odd. Well, I wouldn't disagree. I put that on my mama. Heavy verses like a tree. Trace the roots, blaze the roof like Rap City. Who tryna rap with me? My wrath of them rapper quickly in a split second. I rip records like a disc drive. Pick five rappers. See how many survive? I give them clarity. Nothing like that memory cloud. Such a disparity. I'm one of like the illest around. I do it carefully. Every bar master they crafted for purchase. Even if you don't buy it, I still deserve it. And I'm still imperfect. This whippersnapper still in verses. Get your feelings hurting. Ain't no resisting this disturbance. This that picture perfect. Splitting image of the emperor. M16 to my 16s, the finisher. Ever since 17, I've been repping cleaner than cinema. Sending a message to rappers, sensitive as a fibula. Give us a break. Remove your CDs and tapes. I sign notaries vocally with the scripts that I make. Who won't rap with it?
Yo, that was Jay Nolan with 24/7. The EDM.com track of the week. Rebel Radio is the only show that brings you new music every week from our friends over at EDM.com. So get over there, check out some new music. And now let's get into the interview with Thess One.
I pull the veil like orange pills, the law's will. My friends floating like pirates of Caribbean. Tales of broken spirits, only men that threw them singing racial guns.
I appreciate you being here, man.
Yeah.
I'm glad to see you still doing it.
Yep.
And, you know, I kind of was following you guys in the early days. You know, I used to work at Herb Magazine doing marketing, and obviously they were big fans.
Yeah, we did give us a lot of love. Yeah, a lot of love back in the day. God, I miss those days too.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing I don't miss about those days is we used to finish a song or a record and then it wouldn't get released for like 6 months because they had the service print, and then it would take like 2 months to like get all, and
for sure.
So we would make songs and then not hear them for like, you know, 5 months, and then all of a sudden it would be a single.
Yeah, yeah. And now, and it's already like, owed to you.
Yeah, and now, like, if you make a song, it's on SoundCloud on Friday.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
Different time frame.
So crazy. Well, it seems like everything's changed since back then.
Yeah.
What about, like, so you guys, I mean, I want to get into some of your history and that, but I was thinking on the way here about just, you know, you guys were kind of like, you know, the staple of this underground scene,
yeah,
you know, here on the West Coast for sure, and all over. Mm. And it, like, what does that even mean today to be underground hip hop? And like,
I mean, I would say, honestly, it's probably, for me personally, it's the last thing I would want someone to tack on to the front of our name, you know?
Sure.
Because I feel like it's easy to marginalize a group as an underground hip-hop group. And in 2017, you know, I think partly what has happened since print has gone away and since kind of, you know, we're living in like a post-apocalyptic entertainment industry now, world, and I feel like the consumers, the fans, don't place as much of an emphasis on genre anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, I know I don't. You
for
know,
sure.
Like, if you were to go into my phone, you could skip through what I've been listening to, and it's not all underground hip hop. In fact, if anything, it's not hip hop or underground hip hop at all. You know, like, there are certain things that might fall into it, but, you know, I mean, I'd be more inclined to listen to, you know, like Tori Moi or like, you know, like independent rock stuff or Grizzly Bear or whatever. Like, I have a huge arc of what I'm exposed to now, and it wasn't like that in 1998 when I just was like, I am an underground hip hop fan.
Right.
So for me, you know, for us, for people on the stairs or what I do musically, I think it's more beneficial to just sort of drop, to kind of push away from underground hip hop or hip hop at all and just kind of be an act, because I feel like it opens you up to fans, and it's just really hard to fit in a genre anymore. And if you do fit into a genre, then you have to use all the sort of like tropes of the genre, like, you know, like, oh, it's underground hip hop, and it's like drama, stab, horns, and scratching, and like, you know, it doesn't allow us to evolve as musicians within that style of music.
Sure. So. Well, that's one of the things I always get hung up on is like, so genre, across music, I think is just becoming less important.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, there's a, from your, the way you describe it is that it's limiting, right? But I think the flip side to that is that it's, you know, if you identified in 98 as an underground hip hop act, you kind of knew what to do.
That's true.
Like, you had a limited palette of sounds and topics.
Yeah.
And all of that, right?
It's easy to find your fan base. It's easy to get discovered. It's easy to book shows because they're like, we have a underground hip hop act coming to town.
Exactly.
And, you know, and so, yeah, that was the huge benefit of it. And then the other thing was, you know, I think it was easier for people to be fans of a certain thing because they were like, you know, if you were a dance music fan, you're like, I like dance music. If you're a rock music fan, you're like, I like rock music. Now you get rock music with dance music in it. And it's all like, and everything's just been smeared. And so
you don't know what to hate anymore.
Exactly. And like, you don't know how to find a fan anymore, you know?
Well, you know, people that listen to the show have heard me ask this question, but, you know, from the fan side, what does that do now? Right, because when I was a hip-hop fan growing up, I knew how to dress.
Right.
I knew the slang to use.
Right.
Like, it came, it was a package deal.
You knew the handshake.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you knew who to hang out with.
Right.
At school, or if you went to a party, you'd see the certain sneakers.
Right.
And you're like, okay, that's my dude right
there. Right.
You know? Yeah. And now it's like all the, you know, all those walls are down.
Yeah.
So what are fans supposed to do?
I think on one hand, well, this is the good and the bad thing, right? Like, on one hand, I think at its very best, people are encouraged, fans, music lovers are encouraged to just like what they like.
Yeah.
But that whole idea is obviously being undermined by the genius, the algorithms, the things that get pushed to you based upon what they think you'll like.
For sure.
Which means that there's a perception that you're actually choosing what you're listening to. But as we both know, being veterans in the industry, there's always something being fed to you in a certain way. And
well, I just heard, I was listening to an interview on the way here on Combat Jack with Steve Rifkin, who's an old record promoter guy, label guy. And he was just talking about, I forget what record it was, but, Akon, which was his biggest hit. And he was like, I got that record and I just decided I was going to shove it down people's throats for a year until it broke. And it became his biggest hit of his career. And like, but that's not a unique story. That's what the record industry is set up to do. Is keep showing you something until you like it.
And I think, you know, it's as much advertising and lifestyle marketing as it is just music anymore. And, you know, I mean, I think I read this morning, like Gucci Mane got another $10 million deal. And part of me thinks, where is, you know, like the old school part of me goes, where's the $10 million coming? How are they going to generate $10 million in recoupables when no one buys music anymore? But then I have to remind myself that the real value is in content. It's in the advertising that goes in the front of the video. It's all of these subversive ways that we're being marketed to as music fans, you know, and the music is secondary. So, you know, in terms of going back to like genre and like what people like, I think there's the idea that with streaming music, with playlists, with Pandora, that you are, that it's not being manipulated, that you're in control of it. But I think as we know, there's always manipulation going
on. For sure.
And that's a bummer.
Well, I want to go back to how it got started for you. Do you remember the first record you ever bought?
First record I ever bought. Man. I remember taking my parents, like, records that were my parents' records and kind of, like, making them mine. And so I had this...
What's the one that, like, blew your mind?
I remember, well, it was when I realized what sampling was. So, like, there was this Big Daddy Kane song. And they had like the whole, I didn't know what it was, but I remember listening to my parents' records and hearing the Staple Singer, Sam going like, Big Daddy. And I was like, oh, I can't believe that's they somehow, you know, and then taking the 45, the Staple Singer 45, and kind of bringing it back and putting what I had seen in Beat Street and Wild Style, putting that all together and going, oh, damn, this is a thing.
Yeah.
And I love this music. And, you know, that was really when I wanted to become a producer. I was super young because I didn't see myself, like, I saw rappers as being like LL Cool J. And like these guys that stood on top of like,
yeah, it didn't seem attainable.
No, they were like, you know, jumped on turntables and grabbed dudes by the neck, and I was a fan, but I didn't ever think that I would ever do that.
Right.
So I saw myself as always being kind of a music guy, and then that led me down a road where I was buying tons of just music, you know, being exposed to music, buying tapes, going to Music Plus, going to, you know, wherever I could to get. And I spent all my money on music when I was a kid. And then and I saved up and got a sampler. And, you know, it was the only thing I ever wanted to do. Like, everything else I did in my life was just, it was just trying to help me attain this goal of buying equipment and learning how to do it. And making beats. And yeah, that's all I ever wanted to do.
And were you just making beats by yourself, or was somebody teaching you?
No, I just was kind of figuring it out as I went. Yeah. And then when I was in high school, I met Double K, who's my partner in People on the Stairs. He was at Hamilton and I was at Loyola.
Okay.
And the guys that I knew at Loyola who knew him, they were like, yeah, there's this guy that makes beats at Hamilton. He's better than you. And so they had set up this crosstown rivalry between us. And when we finally met at Martin's Records, we had a whole like beat showdown. And I think we both realized that day that we could talk about music to each other that we couldn't talk about to other people. Like we could talk about Roy Ayers and Bob James and this and that at the same time talking about the Beat Nuts and Wu-Tang and whatever. A lot of people I knew weren't into music like that. So that created a competitive, it was an arms race between him and I. It's who could make the most beats, the best beats, and that competition, out of that competition, we finally realized that we didn't want to give what we were making to other people. Because the MCs that we were giving beats to at the time, the industry stuff we were doing, I think we both could already see us getting taken advantage of. You know, there were independent labels we were giving beats to, you know, each of us on our own, and we were both getting our ass handed to us.
Yeah.
And so finally we were like, you know what, we're just gonna rap over these and release it ourselves. Because it's better than selling the stuff to labels and losing all control over it. And that was kind of how the group started. And then, you know,
so where did that, because earlier you say you didn't have the confidence that you could rap, right?
Yeah. And
you didn't think that was available to you.
Right.
So what changed?
I mean, I think what changed was, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't see any Latino rappers really.
Yeah.
That I felt were worth anything. So I had this sort of notion in my head that it was like, there were just, it was like these dudes from New York and from LA, and I didn't fit into that. Yeah. And I came from a like lower middle class household. Like it wasn't, I was like, I'm not an NWA. Like I don't, you know, right. But I can make music.
Right.
And then, you know, seeing like the Beatnuts and Curious and other like Latino rappers come out, and I was like, oh man, maybe like there is a lane. Like it's not so much about, and underground hip hop was more diverse than commercial hip hop.
For sure.
Analysis. Why am I placed in a situation whack as this? Inquiring mind want to know. Curious George, creativity from the mind and then so. At times I think I'm nice.
And that was one of the things that we felt early on, was that the A&Rs and the people we were dealing with in the industry, they were looking for a certain look in addition to the music.
Yeah.
And it was nauseating to us. So we started flying that underground flag really hard because we felt like, you know, we didn't fit in.
Yeah.
And so the name, we took the name People Under the Stairs kind of regrettably at the time, because we were like, yeah, man, People Under the Stairs, we're underground. We don't,
right?
You know.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
And as you know, you know, like that at the time, the harder you rode for the underground, like it meant something to really be a part of that. You know, we would go to Gavin and Rap Sheet, and we would go to all these conventions, and we'd be the ones that were in the front row at every show that came through, and just studying how things went down and trying to learn from the mistakes that we saw Loud Records making or other, you know, just trying to learn from what was happening and start our own label, you know.
What was thinking about Latino hip hop, like what was the first record that opened your eyes to that?
I mean, there were a couple of big ones like Cypress Hill. Obviously, yeah. just seeing more, I think, more diversity in underground, like Curious, Cypress Hill, Beatnuts, like all that sort of stuff that started kind of coming around in the early 90s. I know there was, you know, Kid Frost and other stuff prior to that, but I also didn't feel like I fell into the sort of
Mentirosa.
Yeah, no, I didn't.
It wasn't good.
Like I was like, yeah, it's like, and the whole like Chicano rap scene existed, but I didn't feel like I fit into that either. I just felt like I was a rap fan. And so I think, you know,
I mean, that definitely felt like ghettoized.
Yeah.
Like to its own thing, right? Like, you know, Kid Frost and Mellow Man Ace. And,
right.
What were those kids?
Lighter like, Shade of Brown.
Yeah, Lighter Shade of Brown. Yeah. Like, it definitely felt like this isn't regular hip hop. Like, it's its own thing.
Exactly. It was an ethnic subgenre of hip hop. And I didn't want to have any part of that either. Because that, you know, that was just as bad as any other kind of like pandering.
Night, Lord Radio and Hellbop on the Bay Bridge faded. Trying to find Smiley's house. Thank God we made it. Yo, blunts brought them beats, keep it low through the streets.
So when you talk about seeing like Loud Records, what's an example of a mistake they were making?
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't say necessarily like a mistake because they released some great stuff, but you know, knowing people who were like kind of going through the process of trying to get signed.
Yeah.
And you know, we were friends with like we knew like Big B and all those guys. We looked up to them. But I saw the sort of politics, you know, like seeing people's records get shelved or seeing or like, you know, just seeing like, you know, Large Professor sign to like Geffen and having like the record shelf, things like that.
Yeah.
It was scary, you know, like because we wanted to be part of the industry, but we also didn't want to be controlled by a label, whether it be like Delicious Vinyl or like any of these. Like, we were just like very cautious. And So, you know, we just were flying that underground flag really hard, maybe a little too hard, because then we started looking at anyone who got signed as being like a sellout.
Of course.
And I'm not sure in retrospect if that's necessarily true either, because there were a lot of good people in the industry who I think were trying to help the artists. But, you know, like my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, was working at, what was it, American?
Deaf American.
Deaf American. Yeah. And she had friends at Wild West and like whatever. And, you know, I mean, it was just the low-key horror stories, things that weren't like public information, but like, you know, just really scary stuff that was happening to artists. And and of course, people signing their life away in deals and not really realizing, you know, what was happening. So
when you thought about that and starting your own label, like, what is the, you know, tell me about now, like, what does it mean to be a label, and what is that, what value does that create in the ecosystem?
I mean, you know, then being a label meant that you had an account at a pressing plant, that you had, you were able to give terms to distributors.
Yeah.
You were like dropping product off net 90 and like,
You
were running a, business.
Sure.
And you had accounts receivable and all this sort of stuff. Now with digital distribution and SoundCloud and you know, TuneCore and all these sort of things, it's not even the same thing anymore. You know, you could say, hey, I'm running a record label, and it's like, well, what does that mean? Like, I put stuff up on SoundCloud for people.
Right.
So
you're like a webmaster.
Yeah, you're a webmaster. You manage a social media account where you put a bunch of photos up. And you know, we signed with Ohm Records kind of soon after we released our stuff independently. Then we were off Ohm Records, and they were like an independent label, but like a big ass independent label.
Right.
And you know, we benefited some from what the infrastructure they were able to provide. Like, they had distribution channels. And I soon realized that, like, when Music Plus and Tower Records and that whole thing started to fall, I'm like, damn, how are we going to sell? How are we going to distribute? How are we going to, you know? And I had a deal with WEA, but I was like, I couldn't even, like, make enough product to get to WEA to all, you know, like, they were just, like, laughing at me. Like, what do you, you know? So labels were important when physical really mattered, but now it's like, I know like kids who are 16 who are like, yeah, I run a record label.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, tight.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
Sure. You know,
it's good, good for you. I don't, you know, for me running the label now, what I do, it means, you know, manufacturing merchandise. It means controlling the digital rights to everything, making sure that everything's in place, filing the appropriate paperwork with Sound Exchange and ASCAP and all these, just you know, making sure that you're there when a licensing request comes through and that you're handling things in a prompt fashion. And I think that's something that the younger generation doesn't quite understand yet.
Well, I think that's interesting because the, you know, to me, the untold story of the music business is just how hard it has always been for the people that make music to get paid from it.
Yeah.
Right. And whether that was, you know, shady, like straight up just people robbing them,
right,
which has happened,
right,
you know, year, it happens every year, or just like the confusing distribution networks and all of that, right? And so now, you know, with all best intentions, it's still really difficult to figure out how much money you're supposed to get from YouTube and from all these different services, and right?
Yeah, and I think the
Because, you know, shit just now gets out there, and then you have these collection companies that got to go find it and ID the files and all that shit.
And I think artists don't, younger artists now don't realize that it is, I had a hard time wrapping my head around this, that you can monetize content.
Yeah.
That Gucci Mane is worth $10 million. It's just not $10 million in record, in like tangible record sales.
Sure.
So it's easy for young artists to sign a 360 deal and get taken advantage of in a way they can't even fathom, because they don't realize that the McDonald's commercial that runs at the head of their YouTube clip is generating revenue that's being collected by the person who, you know.
Yeah.
And those secondary streams of revenue that are coming in from all these different directions, if someone's in a position to collect them, you can still. I mean, the industry still exists, you know. Mm-hmm. We're in a new studio. Like, someone's making money.
Yeah. Well, and all the news is about how now it's growing and it's bounced back and it's, you know.
Yeah, so maybe, I mean,
not necessarily for the artists.
No, I mean, artists are still, you know, I mean, I mentor a handful of younger artists, you know, And I'm always cautious to, like, I try not to tell them too much, because these kids nowadays, you tell them something and they immediately kind of shut down. And I respect that, because, like, the things I experience in the industry, a lot of the knowledge I have from the 90s and the early 2000s is completely useless.
Sure.
You know, like, for instance, we used to have to pay for music videos.
Right.
These kids don't pay for music videos. Like, their friend has a 7D.
Yeah, they just make them.
And they make them. Yeah. And they're out and they're making videos, like 100 videos, generating content. And my old ass, when I'm like, okay, we need to make a music video, and I'm like, oh, what's our budget and our storyboard? And it's for me, it still seems like this massive undertaking. And for these kids, it's run and gun. Yeah. And there's definitely, that helps them navigate the sort of, you know, I guess the world we live in now. And it makes me sort of less apt at, you know, because I'm like an album every 2 years,
right,
a big music video, a big single release, like, and that's just such an archaic, like, irrelevant business model.
For sure.
You know, so yeah. I think those of us who are still around and are still running the same labels, we've had to, like, really change how we look at things, how we operate, you know?
So it's not like, you know, you go into, like, the business side almost more out of necessity, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, again, going back in the day, you could just be an artist.
Yeah.
You get your advance, you get carted around, you come into a nice studio.
Yeah.
And then you just sit back and wait, or you tour.
Was there a break that you remember as, you know, as an artist, when, like, you hit a point where everything got easier, or you?
Nah, everything's been tough.
Yeah.
I still work, like, at night. I have kids now, you know, I put my kids to bed.
Sure.
And I'll stay up and work.
Yeah.
And when I say work, it's not always the same thing. It may be working in the studio, but I'm not always just working in the studio. Sometimes I'm have an Excel spreadsheet and I'm doing sound exchange, right, royalty. Like, I'm,
yeah.
Or I'm designing a t-shirt for merch and putting it on the website and, like, whatever, and doing all these things that'll help make sure that we have the money to stay in the studio and keep working.
So how do you keep the business from interfering with the art?
I think one of the things that's helped, you know, us and what I do is I realize that the business is generated from the fans, and the fans are generated from the art.
Yeah.
So I think it's really easy for some people to start chasing one or the other too hard and not have that balance, or forget maybe why someone might be buying a t-shirt or a sweatshirt. And I try to always remind myself that, you know, they're here for the music first.
Mm-hmm.
So in this day and age, if that means we give away the music for free and we pick up money from these other things, that's what it has to do, because we can't have any barrier of entry to the music. Like, you know, you can't be Metallica fighting the inevitable march of progress, you
right.
know, like, they, I think watching that unfold in the mid 2000s and watching artists end up on the wrong side of that argument and making and basically being at odds with their fans, telling their fans, like, I know you like your music, but, like, F you guys, like, don't share it, don't, you know, that was short-sighted business-wise.
Of course.
So, you know, I try to always remind myself, everything I do, you know, the fans are here because of the music. Give them the music. The other stuff will come. And then when it comes to selling other things to them, merchandise or whatever, keeping it personal, keeping it, you know, making sure that I don't take advantage of them. Like, I don't put up vinyl for pre-sale and then order the vinyl when I get the money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I order the vinyl, wait 2 months, put the vinyl up for sale, and ship it in a week or two.
Right.
You know, I think there's a lot of things that people do nowadays, especially where I read about it or I see it happening, and I'm just like, man, this is not good, and it hurts all of us, all of our trust with our fans, you know?
Yeah.
Or even, like, dumb stuff like the Antisocial Social Club not shipping orders for, like, 6 months or whatever.
Right.
It's like, damn, dude, you have $500,000 in orders you haven't shipped in a way that affects all of us who are doing online sort of, like, limited sales and, you know, releases and stuff.
But I think that's a good example. I was just at ComplexCon this weekend.
Okay.
And, like, last year, Antisocial Social Club was, like, just blew up out of nowhere, like right around that time. It was right before that, but then there at the show, they had the booth with Undefeated, and it was just like
everywhere. Is that when they had the pink car in the booth?
Or yeah, it was a camo.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And then this year, it's gone.
They're in, I mean, they're in big trouble right now.
Yeah, you know? There's like a few people walking around in shirts, but you could tell that moment was over for them.
And there's like there's a petition going around right now that they're trying to get to like the Board of Commerce and like to go after them.
Really?
Yeah, because it's like we're not talking a few orders. We're not talking $60,000. We're talking like $500,000 to $1 million dollars. And as someone who is running a brand that is through our music and whatever, watching that unfold, it's basically again it's one of those things where like here's what I have to make sure we never end up in this position.
Yeah.
Because the trust that we have from e-commerce and our fans and all that stuff, like that's everything, you know? And like, and if you blow that, like you said, like it'll go down quick. Yeah. And,
So what happens? Like, if I just looked on paper, like, your artist, producer, most people in your position have such a little understanding of their business, right? And they show up an hour late and they're high and they're like, there's all these cliches, but they're true in a lot of cases.
For sure.
We've seen it.
Yep.
My thought, I read the Gucci Mane thing last night, and my first thought, because I'm an old dude, was like, who the fuck tweets that you got $10 million?
Right.
Like, you deserve to get robbed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that's the artist way, right? So you got Bow Wow like on the private plane, you have this thing, like,
right?
So what I'm wondering is, like, what makes you different? Like, where did you find the ability to create a different path for yourself? Where's that coming
from? It's a great question. I mean, part of it was how we're going back to what we were talking about, watching the artists and watching how things were handled. And one of the things that I saw super early in the 90s in early 2000s was everyone had a manager.
Yeah.
And I saw the distributors. There was a distributor in the Valley named Ground Level who we ended up winning a lawsuit against. But they owed us money. They owed Hyro money. They owed all these people money. And they were basically in the wind.
Yeah.
And the managers of all these groups were dealing with them. And we didn't have a manager. And so I was dealing with
them. You never had a manager?
No, we never had a manager.
Wow.
Partly in part in the beginning, just because I figured I can do it, it's easier. But I realized that like the managers might not have been negotiating in the best interest of the artist. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because they were taking settlements with the distributors just so that they could get their money and move on.
Right.
And yeah, I was like, no, I need, So then I was like, man, that was like the first time when I realized that like the business side is if the business goes south, it'll kill the artistic vision.
Right.
And so I don't trust a manager to handle that for us. I want to be in charge of that. So then I started handling a lot of the business things. But the biggest change happened when we started touring a lot. We were touring Europe a lot. And when you tour Europe a lot, you kind of get carted around.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a pretty big run in Europe. We did Glastonbury, we did Reading, Leeds. This was all prior to 2000. In 2001, we did Glastonbury with David Bowie and all these big people.
Wow.
And I was coming home, and I'd come home to LA, and I still couldn't book a show for $150 in LA.
Yeah.
And so me and Mike, my partner, were talking, like, man, this is not right. Like, I don't want to be famous in Europe.
Yeah.
I want to be here in the States where people know what I'm talking about, where, it was... So we're like, well, what do? Well, we got to get an agent. So we found an agent who was willing to pick us up, Mike Morey. He was working for the agency group at the time, and he was under Peter Schwartz.
Mm-hmm.
So we were like, man, we are Peter Schwartz, like early, just epic, epic agent for sure. Hip-hop acts. Arguably, I think the first hip-hop artist agent.
Maybe so, yeah.
And so, his assistant started taken on acts, and I made a lot of promises to Mike. I was like, Mike Morey, I was like, pick us up, put us on tour with someone, we'll do the grunt work, we'll do whatever we have to do, we just want to start touring in the States. So he was like, all right, he was booking Calicom at the time. No, he was booking the Deltron tour at the time.
Okay.
So he said, how about you guys go and open for the Deltron tour?
Yeah.
That I was like, 70 Perfect. Cities. That sounds Perfect. Amazing.
Yeah.
How much should we get paid? You get paid $200 a night.
Yeah.
So I'm doing the math. I'm like, dude, I don't think we can make it
yeah.
across the United States at $200 a night. But we did it, and we were able to do it because we didn't have a manager. We didn't yeah. have a merch guy.
Yeah.
So that really, that was like, well, I guess I'll drive the car. We'll sit in a rental. We'll sell our own merch after every show, and we can make it work on wow. $200 a night. Over time, 200 became 500. 500 became 1,000. We're second opener. Then we're the headliner, and then I'm still managing. And yeah. it actually became really easy. But it was really out of necessity and willingness to just work and learn that side of the industry. When we started doing colleges, they wanted to pay us in checks.
Right.
And I was like getting these checks, and they were like, so who do we make the check out to? And I'm like, neither of us, because of taxes.
Right.
So then I talked to Mike. I was like, man, we got to start like a business entity. We got to be able to take these checks. So then I started a corporation called PSOC, and that basically became the People on the Stairs touring business entity. So when mm-hmm. we rented a car, when I bought airplane tickets, all that.
Yeah.
It started going on the Amex card for PSOC. And then when we started, then we're like, well, we need to make more merch. So next thing you know, like, you go from being like an opener to then you're managing like a headline run.
Yeah.
And you're like, you know, you have accounts, you have merch, you have all this and that. So that was kind of, I just kind of fell into it, but I realized that I loved doing it, and it didn't bother me. It wasn't a burden.
Yeah.
You know, because I saw all these other acts with managers. You know, and I'm like, at the end of the night, I'd be sitting there going over the numbers. Like, how many did we do at the door?
Right.
What can we do better next time? And I think that really allowed us to tour the way we did. You know, we toured pretty strong for 20 years in the States. And we went to the point where we could sell out shows in every city. And there mm-hmm. weren't a lot, especially during the recession. Mm-hmm. 2007, 2008, 2009, not a lot of people were out touring.
Yeah.
It was tough. You know, yeah. we were still out there pounding the pavement, playing Milwaukee and, you know, like...
Wow.
We did it.
Nice.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to do it again, but
yeah.
Yeah, that sorry for the long rant, but that's how I fell into it, you know.
I mean, that's great because you know, I can relate. I mean, I started my career as a manager mm-hmm. and you know, I think I can see that it's like I think you have to work hard in that job to add value. Because you're, in a sense, in the way. That's your job, yeah. right?
Unless like, your artist really needs someone taking care of, which a lot of artists do.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
sure. But I get it that like, you know, on the one hand, it's not your money. It's part of your money as a manager, right? But so you're maybe not going to fight as hard.
Yeah.
You know, on the other hand, you know, I've had this conversation where you get opportunities that, for the manager who's making 15-20%, like you need that commission, but it's maybe not the best opportunity for the artist.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I think there's definitely like some conflicts there that, and like you said, some artists, you know, can't get up in the morning.
Yeah.
If they don't have somebody dragging them out of bed or right. whatever.
They can't get an airplane ticket because yeah. they don't have a credit card or whatever. Yeah. I mean, it's...
For sure.
It's... For us, because we fell into that role early, we were able to do it. But like the kids that I know now, they need managers, like all of them, every single one of them.
Yeah.
Like if they got offered a tour in Europe, they couldn't buy plane tickets to get there. Because you have to buy your plane tickets like 3 months out.
Right.
And that's something that, you know, you understand, it's the logistics of touring, the initial outlay that you have to make, where you have to book stuff way mm-hmm. ahead of time.
Yeah.
It adds up. I mean, yeah. there were times where we would go out on the road and I'd be 10 grand in the hole before we even got on the plane.
Right.
Between all the flights that I had already purchased, the merchandise sure. I'd already made and all yeah. that sort of stuff. And that's you have to be willing to take that on. And yeah, I mean, it's tough. And then we also saw, you know, we toured with we headline, but we also were always willing to open for someone much bigger than us, which I think a lot of acts weren't, because they would put ego
sure.
ahead.
Yeah, so of course.
We were able to make decisions, which, we made some bad ones, you know, but...
What like, was your favorite tour that you went on?
Well, favorite, not in a good way, but good manager stories and stuff. There was a group called the Flowbots. Yeah. I don't know if you remember them.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had this. They were these young kids from Colorado, and they had this whole like anti-American, like not anti-American, but they were like, you know, America's in distress.
Right.
And this was during the tail end of the Bush era, and it was really easy to be that group
sure.
at that time.
Yeah.
Their manager left almost $10,000 in a hotel room in Canada on accident.
Oh shit.
And they called us and they were like, we need to go back, all of us. I'm like, we don't need to do anything. You guys left your money there. The money was gone.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But it's shit like that. Oh, sorry, I don't know if I can curse.
No, no, yeah, okay. Yeah.
But we did a show in Ohio at like, I mean, they had a single on rock radio, and like K-Rock had added their song right at the beginning of the tour. So we were opening for them, and you know, the way the song was perceived on the coast was different than how it was perceived in middle America.
Right, right, right.
So we get out to, you know, Ohio. I forget where we were, in the middle of Ohio, and we were playing some convention center, and all these white supremacists rolled up to the show. Like, we were backstage, and there was a balcony, and we could see the parking lot. Confederate flags, neo-Nazis, everyone's coming to the show because yeah. they were under the impression that the song was like a throwback. Right. Like, so, you know, that tour was interesting because we got to see this group who felt so strong, that who lived, kids, they lived in a bubble.
Yeah.
And they got out in the real world, yeah. and they realized that, like, it wasn't, you know, art was, it's not always like that.
Sure. I mean, we hear that now as I talk to DJs mm-hmm. who fly around the country and play, right? And a lot of the kids in the clubs are Trump supporters.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, and you even got to think about your set.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, things have become so polarized. I don't think you can assume, because you make hip hop or because you play dance music or whatever it is, you can't just assume that when you roll up at your spot that everyone's going to agree with you. We tackle rhymes like your life lays time. We trying to get it up. We gotta fill up before it's all gone. The song remains on until the beat stops. Never mind, no need to remind. You know who we be. Yo, it's the capital G's, putting the B's in hip hop, saying hi to the hoes who wear hardly any clothes. Here's looking at you, watching me, the incredible MC. Chicks call me Mikey.
Why is that?
Because I like it. They stare when I'm digging it and know they wanna try. They like the way I rap. They like the way.
There's a Michael Rapaport video right now, and like came out yesterday, that like he's like yelling at people, like, how can you be a hip hop fan and a racist, right? How can that coexist in one person?
Right.
And you know, and I get that thinking, like, but there is a lot of those.
There is a more than I even realized. Yeah, yeah. You know, I got legitimate death threats via Instagram, and I'm not, you know, we've never been a very political group.
Sure.
We've kept that out of our music.
Yeah.
We've tried to be as inclusive as possible, which I think is one of the things that helped us stay around.
Yeah.
But you know, every once in a while I would say something, and I honestly was just trying to encourage people to vote
mm-hmm.
on Instagram. I was just like, make mm-hmm. sure you go out and vote. I don't care who you vote for. And people, you know, started arguing in the comments, and it's you know, and
wow.
Every time you see, you know, I think what's really been crazy in this cycle now that we're in is that people have an expectation of the artist that they love.
Yeah.
And when they find out that it doesn't fit that expectation, they get really ass hurt. Like, that's when you get guys Dimebag Darrelling you on stage. Like,
sure.
They get, the fans can be a little bit over the top.
Yeah.
And not all the artists are sensitive to that, but I think if you have a big fan base, you have to tread. I mean, it's easy to be political and stuff, but you gotta tread light. You gotta respect people's views, I think, you know.
Yeah.
Respect your fans, you know.
Hey, if you're enjoying Thez One, let's stay on the underground hip hop vibe as we go back into the Rebel Radio archives. Check out my interview with Slim Kid Trey from the Far Side. It's a few months back on iTunes or SoundCloud. Look for Rebel Radio. And of course, let's finish up now with Thez One.
So when you've talked about, like, you know, advising or mentoring, mm-hmm. you know, other artists, and knowing that there are some people that need, let's say, a manager,
yeah.
What's the advice you give those people?
I think usually I ask them to be honest with themselves, and I ask them to consider what it means to self-manage, to self-release, mm-hmm. to self-label. And that means, you know, in part, are you willing to take a loan out to hire a publicist?
Yeah.
Or are you willing to put it on a credit card? Are you willing to buy plane tickets to a festival that's been booked in January, but it doesn't happen until, you know, August?
Right.
Can you shoulder that responsibility financially? Can you shoulder the responsibility of answering all the emails, doing things correctly? Because when you're getting ready to go to the festival, you've got the catering person, you've got right. all these people reaching out to you. Are you willing to correspond with these people?
So what about if you, so let's say you need a manager, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, what is the right, like, you should watch your business anyway.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So how do you do that? How would you advise somebody to do that, right? So they're going to hire a manager. They're right. not going to do everything themselves. But you still don't want to get taken advantage of. You still don't want, like, your career to fall apart because you're not paying attention to it.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't know.
It's not an easy question. No. So.
And I mean, I would say that, you know, to be completely honest, both my wife, my family, a lot of my friends, their biggest complaint about me is that I'm incapable of sort of giving up control to other people. Like,
yeah.
you know, if I'm like, hey, we need to release a new t-shirt this fall, I've already taught myself how to learn, use Illustrator and do graphic design. I'm right. upstairs at 3 a.m. doing the t-shirt
right.
instead of delegating the responsibility to other people. That's yeah. Not only is that one of my biggest sort of, I think, flaws, but it's also one of the things that's kept us probably from
sure.
making it bigger. When we, you know, we just did a soft goods release, and we sell a lot of soft goods. So I made 350 hoodies. They sold in like 10 minutes.
Nice.
Then it took me a month to ship them. Because I ship them.
Right.
Because I don't trust someone to get in there and deal with the, because I have had interns and I've had people, especially, you know, like millennials got like a lot, they got like a really bad rap. But all my experiences with millennials, interns, was yeah. it was like dead nuts on. Like, and it happened a couple that's times funny. And I was like, you know what, I'm just going to do it myself.
Just do it, yeah.
But well, that's not the right way always.
But it's funny you say that, right? So I, you know, I work with a lot of really successful people mm-hmm. and I know, and you hear and there's a lot of that, right? There's a lot of perfectionism. There's a lot of people yeah. that need to be in control. And what I always say to those people is, that's what got you to this point, right? That if you didn't have that,
yeah.
and it's also what's going to keep you at this point.
Yes.
Right. And so it's like you have to. Well, what I say is like ask yourself, what are you giving up in order to keep doing it this way, right? And like, and what, you know, how much risk are you willing to take that something goes wrong
right.
in exchange for not having to do it yourself?
Right.
And every person has to find the right balance. It's not, you know, there's no right answer.
No, and I mean, that's directly, you know, relates to your initial question is like, how do you keep track of the business, but also delegate the responsibility to a manager or assistant or whatever? And I'm the wrong person to ask. I'm a good example of someone who stayed a middle-class musician because yeah. I haven't been able to put a team together that we can take to the next level. And I think if that would be the only thing, if I could go back and do it all over again, I might have set things up in a different way that if I were to die, the whole thing wouldn't die with me.
Right.
And that's the scariest thing. It's like sure. I'm the only one who knows how to do all this stuff, and I've been right. really bad about teaching other people how to do it.
Well, I mean, you know, there's always time.
Yeah, that's true.
But, you know, you say middle-class musician like that's a bad thing, but it's also like, it's also amazing to be able to live your life a certain way, doing what you love and you know, and support a family and a business
yeah.
doing that, right? Yeah. And, you know, there's millions of people that would love to have that.
Yeah, I've reconciled myself to the fact there'll never be a year where I make $1 million off music, but there may be many years where we make 100,000,
right?
And that's, you know, I mean, like, yeah. it's not,
yeah,
it's fine.
Yeah. What,
it doesn't fit into the art. Like, so my son now, he's, you know, I've been doing this since before he was born,
right?
And now he's in fifth grade,
yeah.
And people say, what does your dad do? He's a rapper,
yeah.
And they're like, and then they're like, then they look it up and they're like, yeah, he's not really, he's not like Gucci Mane. And he's like, you know, it doesn't fit.
Right. Where's the role?
Yeah. Like your dad drives a RAV. I see your dad dropping off in a RAV4.
Right.
You know, like it's a weird thing.
Well, I think, you know, none of us should be in the business of impressing our son's friends.
No. That's definitely not number one. But it puts you in a weird thing when you're like, you know, go to the PTA meeting and everyone's introducing themselves with what they do. Right. And I always lie. I'm always like, they're like, so what do you do, Mr. Portugal? I'm like, well, you know, I'm in the entertainment industry, work in production. I never, ever say anything about rapping.
That's because funny.
I don't want
parents
to be, you know.
Right.
People are weird.
I get it. So, but you have built a merch business and a touring business, which is two things that I think hip-hop has done really poorly.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Back to genres.
Yeah.
How do you figure out what works and adjust accordingly?
I mean, it's a great question because I think of all the genres, there wasn't a group that we could look at and go, they aged gracefully.
Right.
They did it right. There weren't.
Doesn't happen.
There are people who are still touring and who are healthy, which is in hip hop is, you know, like Master Ace is on tour somewhere right now. To the course and the force is centrifugal. Can you find your way through the lyrics that be catching them? Throw another rhyme across the room, they be fetching them. Then they take a loss to the master. And I throws crazy blows and they knows I be plastering. All across the room, on the ceilings and the walls too. Punk mother flip, didn't know I had the balls to. Come around they block with my cock diesel system and turn it up to 10 and then start to diss them. And they didn't want to battle if they did. But there's like, I can name them on like one hand, the guys who passed the age of 40 and are healthy enough to still
even
tour.
Jay-Z's having trouble selling this tour.
Right.
So, which is like unfathomable, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the rock band that's 50 slots down lower than Jay-Z on popularity will kill it on tour every year.
Yeah. And I think it's a testament to what we were talking about way earlier that, you know, the ideas of this sort of giant sea change artist, they don't fit into that lack of genre, playlist, Pandora thing that this world we live in now. It's, you know, it's hard for me to imagine another Taylor Swift coming out.
Yeah.
Because I just feel like my daughter, who's 8, she'd much rather listen to like, she's like all in like, you know, she's like, oh, I like SZA, but I like this one. Like mm-hmm. She's on some like, or and she's 8.
Yeah.
She's not waiting for the industry to tell her to like some new star.
Right.
They're on YouTube going, they're short attention span in there. And so I think the days of those stars, you know, like Beck drops a new album, which is dope, but Beck's new album is parallel with like the new, you know what I mean? Like there's no value in someone being a massive star anymore.
Right.
They get the same
airplay,
the same amount of time.
For sure. Have there been times along the way that you've questioned the mission?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean,
what keeps you going?
I promised my wife probably 4 times I would retire, like officially retire. And she was like, "Well, what are you going to do after you retire?" I was like, "Well, I'll teach."
Okay.
Teach where? I'm like, I at the college.
There's a place. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a place somewhere where someone will want to listen to what I have to say about this. But then every time I would say that, without a doubt, the phone would ring and it'd be something. Like the first time this happened, we were about to get married. And I said, the week after we get married, we settle into our new house, I'm done. I'm done in the music industry, I'm moving on. The fourth day of day 7, the phone rang and it was Mike Moore, our agent. He's like, hey man, I hope you're sitting down, you're not gonna believe this, but the Simpsons called and they want you guys to be on the 20th anniversary special alongside Flea and Hugh Hefner.
Nice.
And I was just like, hold on. Hey, babe, I'm not retiring. And he's like, and while you're in New York at the studio, I've got a college, in, you know, and then it was like, and then I'm like, all right, well, the retirement is postponed.
Sure.
And so having that happen so many times where something, every time I feel down on it and I feel like, man, I should just stop, I know that there's the possibility that something will come unexpected.
Sure.
And it's like playing a slot machine in Vegas.
That's great. I mean,
keeps me going.
That's a cool way to go out for
sure.
So we were talking before about the competitive nature of hip hop. And I think, you know, hip hop and graffiti, I've had a lot of graffiti artists on the show, and we talk about like that, you know, it's the only art form, like visual art, where there's a battle.
Right.
And
right,
hip hop's
right.
kind of the same way, right? That
right.
it's just ingrained to that. So, so I know you've had some battles with Will.i.am.
Yeah, yeah. We had issues.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, the beat battle thing, they did three of the original ones, and we were slated to do the third one. But what they didn't realize when they booked it is that me and Will had already had some
okay.
run-ins.
Yeah.
And it had to do with a girl I was dating. And, girl, he was,
okay.
and it was like, you know, we just didn't like each other.
Yeah.
So there was definitely an added element to that. But for me, at least, the energy that's drawn from that, and I'm sure the graph writers feel the same way. I mean, the thing that kept, I think, hip-hop evolving from the beginning was the competitive nature of it, was
yeah.
the battling. I mean, it's
yeah.
it's what made dudes stop wearing leather and doing disco rap, because the younger dudes were coming on and just rapping in a circle around it. You
for
know?
Sure.
So I don't see that anymore in hip-hop, and I don't find inspiration in hip-hop, because I don't feel competitive with Lil Uzi Pump or
right.
Lil Yacht or any Lil person. There's no reason for me to, I don't feel any reason that there's no, you know what I mean? Like, I'm
right.
not amped up
yeah.
by it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of a bummer that that doesn't exist. And I think that having a scene in a genre like underground hip hop, I think was really good for that. You know,
mm-hmm.
a new 12-inch would come out and they'd be like, oh, did you hear that new 12-inch? Now it's like, I listen to stuff that comes out. I'm like, that's cool. I'm just going to keep making my music. But I wish it would come back. Like, I wish someone would come and diss me super hard so I could get in the studio and be like, all right, you know, light a fire under my ass, you know?
All right, you hear that?
Somebody.
Give it to them.
Somebody diss the sweatshirts I made, or, you know, I don't know.
Nice.
It doesn't seem life or death anymore. Like, there was a period in time where hip-hop felt life or death to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, it used to, I remember, you know, when the Meek Mill Drake thing was happening,
yeah.
and it was like, well, you know, I remember talking to people about, like, 10 years ago, that would have ruined one of them's career.
Yeah,
that would have ruined Meek's career,
done.
For sure, right?
Yeah.
Now it's ruined for other reasons, but...
Same thing with Nicki Minaj and, like, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. You know, and now, like, the, you know... The Eminem thing, I thought was cool. I'm glad he did that, you know, the Trump thing and whatever.
Right.
But it wasn't like, you know, it didn't have the fire of a lot of his other diss records.
No.
You know what I mean? And I think some of that is just probably where he's at. But some of it is also like, you know, there wasn't some dude that's going to fire back and... Although he probably wasn't worried about Nick Cannon firing back either.
Right. I mean, it's just the whole thing is kind of homogenized, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there's TV shows where they rap battle.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and like,
yeah.
there's a big difference between a TV show with a rap battle and The Bitch in You.
A bitch nigga with an attitude named Q tried to step to the con with a few. What the fuck I look like dissing a whole coast? You ain't made shit dope since America's most wanted deceased. From the Midwest to the East, on the dick of the East for your first release. Your lease is up at the crib house, niggas get a
bit. Like, I thought they were gonna shoot him
yeah.
because of that record. I'm like, dude, you went hard on this dude.
Yeah.
Calling him a bitch and his mom. I mean, like going ham on someone on record.
Yeah. Or toss it up or like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many diss records, so
for
many,
sure.
like, just some of them super regrettable, like, cringeworthy. When you listen to it, you're like, fuck, dude, like, it's gnarly.
All right, I got to get to a lightning round before we get out of here.
All right.
Tell me one decision to change your life forever.
Signing to OM Records.
Okay.
Because we would own the rights to San Francisco Nights. We'd own the rights to... Acid Raindrops, all these songs that have made them millions of dollars over the years, and
yeah.
if a portion of that had come into our pocket, my life would be slightly different right
for
now.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When the stress burns my brain just like acid raindrops, Mary Jane is the only thing that makes the pain stop.
Just let the music take over your soul, body, and mind.
And kick back, relax one time, and you will find.
I try to keep it stress-free, take every day at a time, make sure the
family's in place and let the music unwind. I got plans to take charge like major outlets. I ride around the country chilling in my LA Express on every street corner.
Complete this sentence. I don't have talent, I have blank.
That's my story of my life. I don't have talent, I have just business drive. Like, you know, like I make up for my lack of talent with just the willingness to work.
Okay, that's good. So if I worked for you, what's something I would hear you say over and over?
Let me do it. Never mind, let me do it.
All right.
Horrible, man.
Who would you be most excited to learn as a fan of yours?
Barack Obama. Now I could see it too. I could kind of see it happening, you know? I'm sure he would jam out to some of our music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your favorite city to travel to?
Probably Honolulu.
Mm. So,
yeah. They have a great scene out there. They've got great promoters, and it doesn't feel as competitive, like, promotion-wise out there. Like, I feel like when an artist comes to Hawaii, everybody is like celebrates it.
Yeah.
Here, if you're at one venue, the other venues are like, oh, well, it looks like we're not booking you ever again.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, for sure. Is there a book that's had the biggest impact on you?
Yeah. I think it's called A Surfing Life by Finnegan.
Mm.
And he writes for The New Yorker now, but it's about his life as a surfer and exploring. There's a lot of parallels to making music and touring, you know? So that book had a huge impact on me.
Cool. What movie do you think you've seen the most in your life?
It'd be a toss-up between Caddyshack, Beat Street, and this movie called Fly By Night, which is the best, worst hip-hop movie ever made.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If anyone hasn't seen Fly By Night, I highly recommend checking it out.
I was trying to show my son Beat Street over the weekend. We ended up watching something else, but we'll get there. Beat Street's great.
People can say what they want about Beat Street. I know it's people like to go back and go, well, that wasn't a real hip-hop movie. Wild Style's a better movie. But if you were a kid... Yeah. And that was your experience. Sure. Like, it's an amazing movie. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah, yeah. Fly By Night. I'm going to look for that.
Yeah, Fly By Night's horrid.
I don't know.
But it's good in a bad way. Yeah.
I mean, Caddyshack's amazing.
Classic movie.
Yeah. For sure.
Hey, Doc, can you scare up another round for our table over here and tell the cook this is low-grade dog food, all right? And here, take this for yourself, okay? Jeez, I had better food at the ball game, you know? I tell you, this steak still has marks where the jockey was hitting.
Who's your favorite DJ?
J-Rock.
Dope.
Yeah. Followed by Z-Trip and Jazzy Jeff and DJ Day and like just a bunch of friends. But I would say J-Rock for sure.
Dope. Thanks for doing this, man. I appreciate you.
Thanks for having me.
Being here. Yeah. How's everybody find you?
Best way to follow the merch releases is to follow me on Instagram.
Okay.
And that's at PeaceLock70. Or if you just search for Thess1, you'll find me on there. I'm not on Facebook. I'm not on Twitter. Pretty much just picked one lane, and I do that.
Yeah.
Is
that a good idea for artists?
I think so, because I think, you know, the phone is a huge distraction.
Yeah.
And I think if you're managing three accounts, you don't have time. Boredom is the, like, impetus for all creativity. The border you are, the easier it is to, I think, create art. And I think that this takes boredom out of our lives, and we're just constantly tuned in. And
it's amazing.
Can't make music like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Ah, that's good. That's good advice.
Yeah, hopefully. I don't know. I try to make myself as bored as possible.
Nice.
Hey, that was Thess1 on Rebel Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Make sure you leave us a comment on Twitter at Rebel Radio Net. Leave us a review on iTunes. We'll take your 5 stars. And you can find us on Facebook as well. Check out our YouTube page. Most importantly, come back next week for more Rebel Radio. Peace.